Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said Wednesday he fled the country last month to avoid more violence in the streets of Kabul. As Taliban fighters took control of the city August 16th, Ghani left Afghanistan for the United Arab Emirates in a helicopter. He denied taking government money as he left. I left at the urging of palace security, who advised me that to remain risked setting off the same horrific street-to-street fighting the city had suffered during the civil war of the 1990s, Ghani said in a statement. Leaving Kabul was the most difficult decision of my life, but I believed it was the only way to keep the guns silent and save Kabul and her 6 million citizens. The 72-year-old Ghani said he worked for 20 years to create a democratic government in Afghanistan. But he admitted that he, like other Afghan governments of the past, had failed to create stability and prosperity. The United Arab Emirates said it welcomed Ghani on humanitarian grounds. Ghani said he would give more detailed reasons for why he fled in the near future. He denied accusations that he left Afghanistan with millions of dollars. Russia's RIA news agency reported that he fled Kabul with 4 cars and a helicopter full of cash. He had to leave some cash behind because he could not fit it all in, RIA reported. Afghanistan's ambassador to Tajikistan also accused Ghani of taking $169 million in government cash. The charges are false, Ghani said in his statement. He added that he and his wife have been responsible in their personal finances and has publicly declared all his money and property. Ghani said he would welcome a United Nations review of his finances or another independent investigation. In an interview with Afghanistan's Tolo News Channel, the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was asked if he helped Ghani flee the country. Blinken replied, "What he told me in that conversation the night before he fled is that he was prepared to fight to the death." I'm Dan Novak.
Several Japanese politicians have announced their decisions to seek the leadership of the country's ruling party. The winner will likely become Japan's next prime minister. Fumio Kishida announced his decision to seek the position this week. Kishida presented his economic policies to the leadership of the Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP. The party leads the lower house of Japan's legislature. Kishida is a former foreign minister. He said Japan should aim for a new form of capitalism to reduce disparity in pay between high-paying jobs and low-paying ones. He notes that the disparity has worsened during the COVID-19 health emergency. The race for leadership of the LDP began last week after Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga announced his decision not to seek re-election as party leader. Former internal minister Sanae Takaichi joined Kishida in announcing her candidacy. She proposed conservative policies. Takaichi would become Japan's first female leader if she is elected. Coronavirus vaccination minister Taro Kono has also met party leaders and is seeking the office. Kishida said removal of financial restrictions during the reform period in the early 2000s increased the gap between people with and without wealth. He said that the economic policies under former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, known as Abenomics, increased growth. But he said it did not result in improvements for poor people. Abe supported policies that aimed to fix Japan's financial problems by pushing higher growth and raising taxes. Without distribution of wealth, there will not be a rise in spending and demand, Kishida said at a Tokyo presentation Wednesday. He said Abenomics had brought growth, but it did not provide money to the poor. Kishida repeated a call for government spending and stated again his support for the Bank of Japan's 2% inflation target. Kishida called for setting up a $90 billion university fund to push science and renewable energy. He also wants to keep nuclear energy technology. Takaichi launched her candidacy on policies to strengthen security and help fix damage to the economy caused by the coronavirus crisis. She became the first female internal affairs minister in the second Abe administration in 2014. Local media said Abe supported her campaign. That helped her get the support of 20 lawmakers, which she needed to formally enter the race. The vote for the leader of the ruling LDP is set for September 29th. The lower house of Japan's legislature will hold elections not long after that. So, having a popular candidate will be important for the party leader who follows Suga. I'm Alice Bryant.
Saturday, September 11th is the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks in the United States. Around 3,000 people were killed on that day in 2001 when Al-Qaeda agents hijacked and crashed airplanes in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. people across the U.S. will share their thoughts and feelings about that day on the anniversary. News shows and other media will observe the day with special programming. People will talk about what they remember about the day, the effects the attacks had on them, the U.S. reaction, and more. Such discussions often use verbs in simple and progressive forms. In today's everyday grammar, we will explore the grammar behind such structures. Let's begin with a few important terms and ideas. English has several verb forms. Two of them are the simple and progressive forms. The simple verb form is often the first verb form that English learners study. Consider the following statements.
I want to read about English grammar. I love English grammar.
Here, the verbs want and love are in their simple present forms. Their past forms are wanted and loved. Now consider a person who is in the middle of an action, reading a grammar book. That person might say,
I am reading about English grammar.
Here, the verb read is in its progressive form. I am reading. The past progressive form is I was reading. In general, English speakers are more likely to use simple verbs than progressive verbs in everyday discussions. But discussions about memories and past experiences will likely involve verb forms of both kinds, as we will see. Let's first explore how simple forms might appear in discussions about September 11th. Consider this example. Imagine you are listening to an American news program. You might hear something like the following discussion.
Do you remember where you were on September 11th?
I was at work. I heard about the attacks during my morning coffee break.
Or you might hear a discussion with a person who is not old enough to remember the day.
Do you remember where you were on September 11th?
No, I don't know what it was like, but I believe it was very frightening.
Notice that the examples included simple present and simple past forms of verbs such as remember, believe, hear, know, be. Many of these might be called non-action verbs. Such verbs are mostly used to express ideas, memories, or states of being. Such verbs are less common or not used in the progressive form. Now consider how progressive verb forms might appear in a discussion about September 11th. Imagine you are watching another news broadcast. You might hear the following.
Do you remember what you were doing on September 11th when you first heard the news?
I was listening to the radio, and the regular program was interrupted.
Or,
I was watching television at home.
Or,
I was sitting at my desk when a coworker ran over to me and told me the news.
In the examples, verbs such as listen, watch, and sit appeared in their past progressive form. In other words, these actions were in progress when the person learned about the news. When you hear news broadcasts or read internet discussions about September 11th, or any other kind of important event, pay careful attention to how the speakers or writers use simple and progressive verb forms. Pay careful attention to the kinds of verbs that are used in the simple form and the kinds of verbs that are used in the progressive form. Over time, you will improve your understanding of how and when to use these verbs and verb forms. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week, we talked about slavery in new American states and whether Congress could set the conditions for statehood. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 settled the issue for a short time. The compromise said that Missouri could enter the Union as a slave state, and Maine could enter as a free state. By approving these two states at the same time, Congress kept a balance of power in the Senate between slave and free states. But the compromise also said no more states in the Northern Louisiana Territory could be admitted as slave states. As a result, slavery could not enter the new areas of the United States. Some people did not like the compromise. They said it limited the ability of slave owners to settle in the country's western territory. Others said the Constitution did not permit Congress to say that new states had to be slave or free. Even President Monroe did not believe the government had the power to make such decisions. Yet he approved the compromise. He was trying, he said, to avoid a civil war. Monroe's decision to approve the compromise did not hurt his election chances in 1820. There was, at this time, really only one party, the Republican Party, and he was its leader. The opposition Federalist Party was dead. It was no longer an election threat. So Monroe was the only presidential candidate in the election of 1820. He received the vote of every elector except for one. William Plummer of New Hampshire voted for John Quincy Adams. He explained later that George Washington had been the only president to get all the electoral votes. Plummer said he did not want anyone to share this honor given to Washington. Monroe's first 4 years as president had been successful. He had increased the size of the United States. Florida was now part of the country, and the problem of slavery had been temporarily settled. There had been economic problems, some of the worst in the nation's history, but the situation was getting better. And the nation was growing. As it grew, new problems developed between its different sections. There were really three separate areas with very different interests. The northeastern states had become the industrial center of the nation. The southern states were agricultural, with large farms that produced cotton, rice, and tobacco. Much of the work on these farms was done by slave labor. The western states were areas of small farms where grain was produced with free labor. It was a place where the land did not cost much and where people could make a new start and build a new life. This division of the nation into different sections with opposing interests ended the one-party system of Monroe's administration. The industrial Northeast wanted high taxes on imported products to protect its industry from foreign competition. This part of the country also believed the national government should pay for roads and waterways to get their products to markets. The South did not agree to high import taxes. These taxes raised the prices on all goods, and import taxes on foreign goods might cause foreign nations to raise import taxes on Southern cotton and tobacco. The South also opposed spending federal money for roads and canals. The mountains through parts of the Southern Atlantic states would make road building difficult and canals impossible. The Western states supported government aid in building roads and canals. The Ohio and Mississippi rivers were the only inexpensive transportation systems for moving their products to markets. The Westerners also supported high taxes on imports because they believed such taxes would raise the prices of their agricultural products. The separate interests of these different sections produced an exciting campaign in the next presidential election. Each section had at least one candidate. Several had more than one. The campaign began almost as soon as Monroe was elected for the second time. At one time, as many as 16 men thought of themselves as presidential possibilities. By 1822, the number had been reduced to 6 men. John Quincy Adams was the only Northern candidate. He was an extremely able man. He was at the time Secretary of State, and there were few jobs in government he could not do and do well. But many people found him cold and questioning. His father was John Adams, the second President of the United States. The West had two candidates. One was Henry Clay of Kentucky, popularly known as Harry of the West. He was a great lawyer, congressman, Speaker of the House, and senator. The other was Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. Jackson knew little about government. He was a fighter, a man of the people. In the election of 1824, Jackson got the most electoral votes, 99, but he needed 130 to win a majority. The Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, was second. Treasury Secretary William Crawford was third, and Henry Clay of Kentucky was fourth. Because none of the candidates got a majority of the votes, the decision went to the House of Representatives. The House voted on only the three top candidates for president. The most powerful man in Congress, Henry Clay, was not, therefore, a candidate. But Clay's support would be the greatest help any of the candidates could receive. All three wanted his support. Treasury Secretary Crawford had suffered a serious illness before the election, and his health was bad. Clay felt he could not support him for that reason. This left Adams and Jackson. Clay did not agree with all of Adams' policies, but he did believe Adams had the education and ability to be president. Clay did not like Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He knew Jackson was poorly educated and easy to anger. Clay did not think Jackson would be a good president. So Clay decided to support Adams for president. He said nothing about this for a time.
Several of Clay's friends visited Adams. They told him that Clay's supporters in the West would be pleased if Adams, as president, named Clay as Secretary of State. Adams told them that if the votes of the West elected him president, he would put a Westerner in his cabinet. But he would not promise that the Westerner would be Clay or that the cabinet job would be Secretary of State. Clay had still not said publicly which candidate he supported. But late in January, a Philadelphia newspaper published an unsigned letter. The letter charged that Clay and Adams had made a secret agreement. Clay, the letter said, would give his support to Adams. In exchange, Adams would name Clay as his Secretary of State. Clay was furious. He not only denied the charge, but offered to fight a duel with the letter writer. But whoever wrote the letter to the newspaper refused to say anything. Clay was sure Jackson's supporters were responsible. Snow was falling in Washington on the morning of February 9th, the day that Congress would elect the president. At noon, members of Congress walked into the House of Representatives. Each state had one vote for president. Adams was sure he would get the votes of 12 states. Crawford had the votes of 4, and Jackson, 7. New York was the question. 17 of the New York congressmen were for Adams, and 17 were against him. Adams needed just one of these votes to get the vote of New York and become president. One of those New Yorkers opposed to Adams was a rich old man who represented the Albany area, Stephen Van Rensselaer. Although Van Rensselaer had supported Crawford or Jackson, he really was not sure now whom to support. When the New York congressman voted, Van Rensselaer was still not certain. He put his head down on his desk and asked God to help him make the right choice. After this short prayer, he opened his eyes and saw on the floor at his feet a piece of paper with Adams' name on it. Van Rensselaer picked it up and put it in the ballot box as his vote. This gave Adams the vote of the state of New York and made him the next president of the United States. 2 days later, Adams told President Monroe that he had decided to offer the job of Secretary of State to Clay. He said he was doing so because of the Western support he had received. Clay accepted the offer. Now Jackson was sure that Clay had sold his vote to Adams for the top cabinet job. He wrote to a friend, "Was there ever before such barefaced corruption? What is this trade of vote for office, if not bribery?" Jackson, himself a senator, showed his feelings when the Senate was asked to approve Clay as Secretary of State. He voted no, and 13 other senators joined him against the nomination. But they were too few to prevent Clay from getting the job. With Clay as his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams began his first term as president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.